You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that's the Persian crossover band Axiom of Choice with the Chaos of Paradise. April 22nd is Earth Day. While one might think that climate activists might be welcome these days, given the dire shape of our Earth, that seems not to be the case. In what some suggest is a taste of what is to come, in England last Monday, more than 200 police officers carried out a preemptive raid, arresting 114 people suspected of preparing a protest at the Radcliffe-on-Soar power station in Nottinghamshire. A day later, it emerged that while those detainees were being held, police officers raided homes around the UK, seizing computer equipment and mobile phone records. Spokesman Mel Evans of Climate Camp and Tim Green, a criminal defense specialist, say this crackdown is an attempt to chill major demonstrations planned for the summer. This, says Tim Green, is an effective way of occupying at least these 114 people from any further protests for at least the next 3 months. They are completely prevented from seeing and talking to each other, from going to any more protests, lawful or unlawful, and that is the priority of the police. Mel Evans of Climate Camp concurs and says the police are using these tactics to quench a growing social movement which has been flourishing over the past few years, that has been protesting government and corporate decisions that fly in the face of climate science. And this is a broad-based movement with people of all ages, all backgrounds, trying to force a conversation about what we need to do about climate change for the people across the world. Someone who is doing what she can to celebrate the Earth's bounty and to bring it back to the land of her birth is Afghan-American Asma Eshin. She represents the organization Afghans for Tomorrow and is also agricultural director of the Bare Roots Project, whose mission is to green Kabul's hills. For the last several years, Asma Eshin has led a small team to Kabul for this greening project that plants trees in the hills around and inside Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. She talks to us by phone today, having just returned from Afghanistan.
We went and planted trees in Afghanistan. We planted and distributed over 6,000 trees, and we've been doing this for the past 5 years. And it's a very small project. We go people to people, and we meet the shura, the council, and ask them what kind of trees and what they want. And we gave it to them. And we also go back to our old projects and see how they're doing and if they need more trees. So out of almost 25,000 trees that we have planted in the past 5 years, I would say about 90 to 80% is thriving.
So every year you go back and they're a little bigger.
So it's like I call it a chain link. We go to the old projects, talk to them, see what they want, and before we leave, we always have one or two new projects. I've been with Afghans for Tomorrow since 2003, when my first time I went to Afghanistan. It's a very good, small but very effective NGO. It's very volunteer-based, so we as directors or secretaries or whatever, we do the work, we do not have any expenses, but the money that we raise and give is for our schools. Our project we have is called Bracket at schools, and another place that we work with disabled children. So that's under agriculture. And then this project that I am co-founder of, Bay Root, that every spring we go anywhere, people from the United States, especially more from Bay Area, between 5 to 10 people will go and meet Afghan people one-to-one, have lunch with them, and plant trees. The planting trees is the secondary, but the first is that we make connection with these people, that we are not, quote-unquote, friendly fire. We are really human with lots of emotions. We care for you. And that's when they're really happy. They always say, they can't believe it, especially my travelers companions are usually been in Afghanistan two or three times. And they see the continuity of this. That's what's more important. And they see me that I said, I'll come back. They said, you're really going to come back? Because they have been promised so many things and never happened. Mm-hmm. And that's more important to us to show. The tree is just as a gift.
But it's also a very important gift. And that hill that you were planting on last year is a hill that used to be covered in trees.
Yes. And it's amazing, the Tape Maranjon or Nodesho Hill, our trees that we planted the first year, 2005, 2,500 of them, is thriving. I wish I could show you listeners the photographs. They were just this 12, 14-inch saplings, and now they are 2-3 feet tall. On that project, we paid for security guard, water, and gardeners for 3 years to make sure that they were taken care of. And there are other NGOs are moved in, and because the hill is pretty big, and the Department of Agriculture also has put in trees. It's already, you can see, it looks really great.
And this is the hill where the children used to fly the kites.
Yes, and they still do. Yeah. It was very mined. It was, and then Halitrust and other demining companies demined it first, and then we could go.
Asma, let's talk a little bit about President Obama's latest policy towards Afghanistan. What are people in Afghanistan, well, in the area that you were in, which was predominantly Kabul, what are they saying?
They're saying that they really do not need to have these superpower machinery and artillery and helicopters and guns in Afghanistan to govern people and move in a better society because it's very disconnected. It's very expensive for the United States and it's very costly for Afghanistan because what happens when the Congress, for instance, say they're going to give Afghanistan like $72 million, but people don't understand that the $72 million, a whole chunk of it goes on the military and another chunk goes for these security companies and then administration. At the end, if you get a penny for Afghanistan, they should be happy. So the money is wasted on that concern. When I spoke with the local people, they the one told me, for each soldier that is in Afghanistan, they calculated that they can train 5,000 soldiers and pay them $500 a month for a whole year,
uh-huh.
for each day that there's American soldiers there.
What do you make of that?
I think they are right. I think they make sense that let's, instead of bringing soldiers from the United States and have it very expensive, have that money be set in Afghanistan, train the soldiers the right way, pay them the right way, have a health care for them so they will not go for bribery. Bribery comes from necessity. It doesn't come from a place that one wants to be bribing or one become a corrupt. That's why United States, I think the United States government or the county or the state employees doing so well because they get their salaries, they also get health care, and they all get their retirement, right? So it stops them from
needing to take bribes.
Exactly. And that system needs to be back in Afghanistan. If we had the same system there, I think we solve a lot of problems.
And yet that seems to be such a simple, straightforward, common sense view of things, and yet it seems as though the mainstream thinking about what Afghanistan needs and is not getting that point at all.
No. It was very heartbroken to see all these God-guzzling armament going past by us when we were going 40 kilometers north of Kabul to plant trees. And the checkpoints and the helicopters, and I'm going like, who's the enemy? I cannot find the enemy. If you want the real true enemy, you have to train these people. There are hundreds of youth, Afghan youth, that who can be trained. Mm-hmm. Not as the soldiers of Al-Qaeda or Taliban, as a civil service soldiers for their own country.
And Obama is also talking about sending 4,000 advisors to train, as you say, to train the Afghan army.
If he works with the model that I just spoke about, that the Afghan people say, train us and pay us, take care of us, we will take care of our country, that would work.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it gets going to get lost on some fancy policy. You know, that's the thing is, writing a policy is beautiful when you're sitting on a comfortable chair looking over Manhattan. But implementing the right policy for a poor country like Afghanistan is very difficult. Need to go be in the ground, be with people.
But that also means understanding the culture and understanding the language, doesn't it?
Exactly. You need the culture, you need understanding. And we forget that these Afghan people in Afghanistan had gone through tremendous hardship, mm-hmm. not just by Taliban, but the civil war moved the majority of them migrated or that became refugees in Pakistan and Iran and northern countries, and then they have to come back and resettle. That itself takes a lot of psychological,
strength.
The strength, yeah. But to see these people every morning smile at you and make a cup of tea for you and welcome you in their little shops or their homes, I'm amazed by. Because if I would be in the West, we'd probably go to our psychologist and get a bunch of drugs.
Last year we talked about the situation with the widows in Kabul. Are you still seeing as many widows?
Yes, and I'm very, very saddened about the widows, and I'm saddened about the new Karzai's law on women. I'm just writing my policy memo for myself, thinking that maybe I'm going to print this, that it is so ridiculous. He's a man who lived in the United States. He understands how it works. He doesn't even bring five Shia women in his cabinet or in his table. Say, let's talk about this. Let's see what you have. This chauvinist, domineering, Islamic male, on top of a woman. I'm very saddened because women's life is very hard for women. There's still 80% of women in Afghanistan are widows, and they have to feed their families. They have to take care of themselves. But then you have a man like that, Karzai, coming out with this Shia law, and he's making division right there mm-hmm. also. Division between the Sunnis and the Shias.
And part of what he's trying to do now is shore up his position, isn't it? His political position.
Very much for election. He wants to gain for the election. And I'm really kind of puzzled by this, because where does he get this money? Is it coming from Iran? Because Pakistan is Sunni majority of it, and only to the left is Shia, is Iran. And when I grew up, majority of Afghanistan was Sunni. Very small percentage was Shia. But I should not say Shia, Sunni. They are Muslims and they are Islamic people. Mm-hmm. But it is very, very saddening. The widow woman does not need this. I got to tell you a story. We were in the refugee camp, and this nomad girl came. She was the most beautiful creature I ever seen. She must have been about 20, and she had about a 5-year-old girl and another girl. And she was already hinting back. Mm. And she says, my shoulder hurts, this hurts, I have to go get water, I have to carry the kids, I have to bring the wood. And this woman, you know, she's only 20 years old. It's enough that she's gathering woods for you, but then on top of it, she has to give your child at the same.
Talk a little more about the refugee camps. Is there an influx of refugees in or out, or what's the situation if you can compare it to last year?
There are 2 million refugees as of last year outside of Afghanistan, but now they're all coming because Pakistan has a policy, started a policy 3 years ago that slowly they're allowing Afghans to come in because they want to get rid of all the refugees by year of 2010, which is next year. And it's Kabul has grown over, I would say, over at least, if not a million, not too far from it, new people. The refugee camps that we worked last year, they were only 450. This year was 650. And that is another problem that they have, that they what happens, they bring these people and they set them on a desert land and they tell them to survive. Homestead, that's fine if you want to let out some people homestead, but at least give them water. Because during the west of the United States, people homestead by the river or by some place where it was forest. Here's a plain old desert.
And this is still UNHCR sponsored and run?
Yeah, and we work with this refugee area called Sharaki Naween, and some other organizations have come in and have slowly helping them. but there's no, there's a school. They built a fantastic school. But then again, they spent a lot of money on the building. They spent over, I'm sure they spent over $100,000 on the building, but there's no school supplies. And it's like, make small schools, make it out of mud schools, but make sure is there's supplies, there's a teachers. Yeah. They don't even have a teacher because the community decided that they want to teach their own children because the Department of Education does not have a teacher for them. There's a lot of shortage of teachers. Absolutely no material. I walked in there and the kids were sitting on these broken desks and there was we call it blackboard. And again, like turn of the century, rote learning. The teacher says and the students repeat it. So I want to share one story with you because this is the future of Afghanistan if we don't do something. I was at the game of Pushkasi in north of Kabul. And I was a whole bunch of youth were gathering around me. And then there was a one young man. I looked at him and he dressed up like Palestinian young men. You know, they have the white checkered fear. Yeah, I looked at him and I said, you're Afghan. Why are you dressed up like this? Why don't you dress like Afghan costumes? And I pointed to a couple of people who were standing on my left. I said, how about this man and that man? He looked at me in the eyes. He goes, what is Afghan? What makes you think I'm Afghan? I says, I look at you in your eyes, I see Afghan, you're Afghan. I see it in your face and your smile. He goes, well, it doesn't matter if I'm going to be working with the Arabs or working with Americans. Nobody cares. I said to him, I says, you might not understand this at this time, but if I pick you up and take you to Dubai or Kuwait or someplace, you will see the way those Arabs treat you, and if I take you to my hometown in Northern California and see how those people will treat you. I said, there is difference, believe me. They're using you to be their soldiers. And he looked at me and he walked away and I forgot about him and I turned around, came back. Next thing I know, he was standing right next to me and he had put his keffiyeh under his shirt. And he turned around and we had this conversation. He goes, ma'am, the teacher does not have any supplies. The teacher does not know how to teach. What is it you want from me? And I went, looked at him and I said, I understand you're losing your identity. Mm-hmm. And this is where we need to get help. Mm-hmm. We need to go and help there. And I'm really thinking, how am I, Asma, gonna go and help these youth? Mm-hmm. And that's what's all, because if we forget them, they're the one who's already going to move to Al-Qaeda or Taliban because exactly. He has nothing else to do.
Well, I mean, I think that's an important point you're making here, Asma, is these refugee camps were actually the birthplace of the Taliban mentality
right.
that we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now it's happening inside of Afghanistan.
And it's inevitable, isn't it? I mean, every young person wants and has the huge desire to live a life that's righteous, really. And if they're not given the opportunity, they're going to fill in the gaps.
Very impressionist age, and they know their human rights is not been met. So back from that aspect, going back to the military, we is putting money on the wrong place again. If you recall last year, I said to you that these security companies taking hold of Afghanistan, and it's the same thing. The money goes to security companies. Unfortunately, majority of security companies are from South Africa because they finish in South Africa. They all moved in Afghanistan.
This is Raising Sand Radio with Susan Gallimore talking with Asma Eshin of Afghans for Tomorrow and Bare Roots Project. Asma returned from her fifth trip to Afghanistan last week, and as she has been doing over there, planted around 4,000 trees. I asked her to shed light on the Taliban.
Well, people are kind of much more conservative than they were last year or the year before. They know there's a presence of something out there. You can tell that young Taliban, because they are the one who wears black clothes, and they wear the turbans. You know, they even if their hair is a light brown, they color it dark black. So they are. You have to understand there are three kinds of Taliban. One is the old people, I would say over 50 plus. They're not old, but in a sense of what the way I'm thinking is old. So. Forgive me if I say old. They are people who do not want the culture to change. they are on the in the background, and they keep saying, you know, we can't change, we cannot have this, we should have the old way. They kind of in between cultures. They don't understand the new culture, but yet they're missing the old culture. And then there's the middle point, who are the, I would say, around from 25 to 45, that they are working people, but they are still not sure how to be. They are pulled by their older people, which is their fathers, and then at the same time, they are pulled towards the new modernization. Mm-hmm. So they are in between, and they are the one who send off money to Taliban. And the third Taliban is the youth, the one I was saying earlier, that who have nothing to lose. They are the soldier, foot soldiers. And they're the one I call the gangs. I really, to me, if you ask me what's Taliban, Taliban is no different than any gang in anywhere in South America or in our Los Angeles or in Vietnam. This just reminds me of like M13 gangs in LA. And we have given them so much power by not giving them resources to move forward. So that's about Taliban. And I have to tell you, Sue, I had tea at someone's home that I felt that he was Taliban. I don't know if he was, but I felt he was Taliban. And the reason I say that is because it was on that refugee camp. Last year, I dressed up as Northern Afghani kind of clothing, like the chapan, which is Karzai wears it. I made one for myself. And I had this scarf from my Northern people. And I really believe that I was marked, because the next thing I know, this wonderful man invites me in his home and my group, and we start talking, and he was feeling me out and feeling the group out. And he was saying he was from North and stuff. I keep looking at him that he has no look from the North. He looks so from Southern Afghanistan. But I said, that's okay. And we start talking, and he realized that politically I'm in center. I'm for him and for his kids. I said, the Taliban, you know, is the tradition we want, you guys want to want. But I understand why your youth becoming the soldiers, the foot soldiers, because they have nothing else to do. Mm-hmm. They get more power to give him a gun. And I think we have to do something about armament. Because even people buying guns in America and all over the world, we got to move from the cowboy mentalities. Come on. That was so long ago.
Hard to do, easy to say.
Well, yeah. Well, it actually starts from very young age in early childhood education to teach young boys to be sensitive and cry and let's play a different way and, you know. Mm. But no. Guns are the man. It comes back that mindset, that change. Change brings people fear. And we all work from fear-based. When you work from fear-based, really changes you, and you say, I cannot change. So we must teach people change is hard, but we must do it.
Talk a little bit about the schools that you're supporting, Afghans for Tomorrow.
Well, our schools are doing very well because we get volunteers from the United States, like English teachers and people like science teachers. They go and do a lot of hands-on. In Kabul, all over Kabul, in our own school, we have one project, like I said earlier, Bracket. They go out in the yard outside of their school. They gather paper and they gather garbage in a sense, but we have gloves and stuff. And then they make these Brackets and they sell it so they can support the school also for mm-hmm. sustainability. Mm-hmm. And we watched them. They did it. It was fantastic. Our school has uniform. They teach English, sewing, reading, writing. It has grown. The other thing is happening in Afghanistan, in Kabul especially, even in I heard that even in Herat, in Mazar-e-Sharif, the big cities, a lot of centers. All of a sudden, the young families realize that they want their children to be educated and their children be bilingual. There are a lot of people want to know speak English, their kids. So the Afghans for Tomorrow has an English class also, but like if someone graduates from University of Kabul, which I and the director interviewed, is teaching English, but unfortunately she can't speak it, so that there's a disconnection. So, but then these new centers open up that offers all kinds of after-school program, study programs for youth to enhance their education, and parents pay for this. So there's a growth, there's a movement on that. And our two schools that we have in Kabul is doing very well, but our third school in Wardak is not doing very well, because in Wardak, it's again, we have the problem of having a school and the girls coming to school. And I suggested, and we had a meeting suggested that what we do is go ahead and not just homeschooling, but homeschooling within the same street. In Afghanistan, each street has different tribes or different families, and they might not feel trust towards the other tribe or the other family. So if you do it within the same street or area or kala, you call it, then you have one teacher to do the same student. And some of our teachers are no more than 12 to 14 years old, because when there's a mother in the house, she doesn't have time. So they have to live so primitively to make the dinner and sewing or whatever they need to move. You know? And then Mr. Kaza has to bring more law on top of that. You can see I'm kind of enraged with that. So that's where we're working on this. And there are not enough teachers in Afghanistan. The good teachers are all gone to non-profit organization schools such as ours, because we pay top dollars for their salaries. And anywhere else is kind of difficult. But there was on the news something wonderful that three girls from Kabul schools won a gold medal for their science project in Central Asia. So, you know, like I said earlier, there's a discrepancies, but then there's a really good things. There are a lot of roads were fixed. The traffic flow is much better. If you have money, you can get the most fresh fruit and vegetable in the world.
And if you don't have money?
You go hungry. I saw a man, was collecting old bread, and I think they gave the old bread to the goat. He was sitting there and cleaning and was eating it, and it broke my heart. But Afghans are resilient, and they'll be okay as long as we be behind them, and as long as we will go forward and be sensitive for the change. It's hard for them to change. And we're asking too much from them at this point, because they've only been free, 7 years? I want to go back to the military. One point, as much as you don't want the American military in Afghanistan's presence, but at the same time, if this is my own personal thought, is good to have the Afghanistan military or something very forceful in Afghanistan. The reason I'm saying that, when you have the military, Obama sending 4,000 soldiers, there are 4,000 families all of a sudden focusing in Afghanistan. And out of this 4,000 families, the soldiers, one or two, might send, write an email and tell the condition. Out of the 4,000, maybe one or two of the parents or sisters or cousins want to start some kind of cause for Afghanistan. So it will affect Afghanistan. So this is the one part. And the other part is that we don't need all that machinery. We don't need all this helicopters going around Afghanistan and the huge military vehicles going through Kabul. But if you're there, then you're focused, because if you recall in the 1980s when America left, Afghanistan fell in the civil war, the next thing you know was Taliban came and it became chaos. So it's a very double-edged sword. You see, it's one part is good because it makes us aware of it. When American soldiers there, we're very in it. And when American soldiers move back, we're out of it. We're giving too much power, and that's where we have to work on this power to equalize it for human rights versus militarism.
Asma, you'll be going back again next year?
Yes, or am I thinking maybe this summer, because the economy is slow here. Maybe I'd like to go find that young man and talk to him and work with youth and give him some hope.
So if you go in the summer, will you be taking a delegation again?
No. This time I'll be going to do some research and work.
You will be going next year, and people can get in touch with you through Afghans for Tomorrow.
Afghans for Tomorrow, just info@afghansfortomorrow.com.
And what about the trees? How do you people donate and you purchase the trees there?
Yes, we have always decided to take the money there and put the money in the economy of Afghanistan. We went for 11 days and we spent $11,000, $1,000 for Afghanistan. And it's very good. It's not much really because the trees that we bought was $2 a tree and we bought 6,000 trees. And another trees that we bought like apples were less than the $2. And we bought rose bushes. So everybody has to pay their own way. The airplane fare and the housing, lodging, all has to come individually. But we collect the money we collect, we spend it on the ground for buying the trees, buying lunches, buying clippers, buying gloves, whatever the gardeners needed, and water, we take care of that.
So you have really created a little micro-business industry back there, haven't you? You've got the tree growers, and you've got the people supplying the goods that you use. You've got the food.
Yeah, and then, you know, they spend their own money also. Yeah, because to me, if you want to go to Afghanistan, I just can't stand to say, well, give me $20 and 14% or 15% of it is going to go for the administration of my work. And I'm going like, well, yeah. I don't want to make money. I do not start a business on behalf of Afghans.
It was Asma Ishan of Afghans for Tomorrow and Beirut's project. Get in touch with her through www.afghansfortomorrow.org, afghansfortomorrow.org. During our conversation with Asma Ishan, she mentioned Khalid Hosseini's book, The Kite Runner, that features the hill upon which Beirut is planting trees. According to the American Library Association, which compiles an annual list of the most challenged titles in the country, The Kite Runner is one of the books that inspired the most complaints in America last year. This best-selling and critically acclaimed story of a 12-year-old Afghan and the betrayal of his best friend includes the rape of a boy that provoked challenges in the U.S. over what objectors saw as sexual content and offensive language. Some objections led to the removal of the book from library shelves, while others saw it replaced with abridged versions minus the offending scenes. Topping the list in 2008 was, for the third year running, Justin Richardson and Peter Parnell's book, And Tango Makes Three, a children's book about two male penguins who bring up an orphan chick. Based on a newspaper story, the author saw about a zookeeper who noticed two of his penguins trying to hatch a stone. The book was criticized for being pro-gay, anti-religious, and anti-family. Books that address same-sex parenting or same-sex relationships are particularly prone to challenges in the United States, said Deborah Caldwell Stone, deputy director of the ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom, which has collected information on challenge books for the last 20 years. In the case of And Tango Makes Three, there are many parents who believe it inappropriate to teach children anything at all about homosexual relationships, even in the form of a picture book about a true story. Philip Pullman's trilogy, Dark Materials, rose to second place overall in 2008 from fourth the previous year. He said his reaction on hearing the news was glee. They never learn. The inevitable result of trying to ban something, book, film, play, pop song, whatever, is that far more people want to get hold of it than would ever have done if it were left alone. Why don't the censors realize this? And in a roundabout way, this brings me to our next segment today on art and culture in Afghanistan. Thanks to Farhat Ashufta, videographer, for sharing the video for this segment from a recent event at San Francisco's Yerba Buena Center. The event was called Liminal Spaces, Afghan Culture and the Future of South Asia. A four-person panel from which these excerpts are taken was part of the preview screening of Shireen Pasha's movie Slowly, Slowly, Mud and Lotus. The panelists were Tamin Ansari, author of West of Kabul, East of New York, Robert Abdul-Haydar, student of traditional Islamic culture, Shireen Pasha, the storyteller and filmmaker whose movie it was, and Bina Sakhar Elias is a founding publisher, editor, and designer of Gallery, an award-winning global arts journal. We begin with Taman Ansari. Again, Taman Ansari, author of West of Kabul, East of New York, born and raised in Afghanistan. Taman Ansari has lived in the United States since 1964. He directs the San Francisco Writers Workshop and teaches at San Francisco State and UC Berkeley.
All I want to say as a launch for this discussion is that several times when I've talked about art in Afghanistan, the question has come up in a country as devastated as Afghanistan, what place does art have? Shouldn't it be all about food and medicine and shelter? And I'm just thinking that when I went back to Afghanistan in 02 or 03, I forget, the years start to blur now, it was right after all of this terrible stuff had happened. And you know, for years the Taliban had put this clamp on Afghanistan, and I was there right after that had lifted. And everywhere I looked, I saw this kind of bursting out and flowering of art that nobody had to promote it or stir it into action. Many people who have traveled there know about Oshionov, but some of you may not have, so I'll just give this little anecdote for you, that there is a place in Kabul where a guy named Engineer Yusuf has set up a school for street children who wouldn't be able to go to school because they're busy working during the day selling garbage that they find in the streets. So they can go there and study any time of day or night that they have a moment. And he thought that one of the things that would be good for kids like that who, you know, they've suffered a lot of mental trauma and you can't really afford to give them psychiatric help, give them some art supplies and let them express themselves. And so these kids are very enthusiastically doing this, and they sing, they do calligraphy, they paint. And for painting, they don't give them art classes. All they give them are old pictures, like from National Geographic or the covers of some magazine or something. And the kids just essentially, supposedly, quote-unquote, copy this stuff. And I'm going in there, and I'm looking at, and I wish I had the video, I could show you this. And I'm looking at this kid who's got this paint, and he's just studiously, supposedly, copying this this landscape with some trees and some houses in it. And his picture is like this, and it's just beautiful, and it's so expressive, and it's so, in a sense, maybe because of what I saw a moment later, it's so full of heartbreak, because it's a beautiful painting. It only technically reproduces what he sees in the picture. And when he turned around, I saw that like half his face was gone. This is a kid who's been hit by a landmine, and he's producing this beautiful thing. The Kabul University, which had just opened, was immediately offering art classes again. And I went in there, and I, with my video camera, I was hovering over this guy who was making a border for an illuminated book. Later, he would add the calligraphy, but for now, he just had this paintbrush that was like hair thin, and he had little. He was just like adding one dot and then one dot, and I was taking a picture of that. So the art was bursting out all over, and I feel like there is something as essential to human life about art as about these other things I mentioned, food, water, and shelter. And so I'll leave it at that for now because I don't want to take up all the time. Pass it on to the next person. Gordon?
Robert Abdul Haydar is a student of traditional Islamic culture who studies North Indian classical music, Persian language and literature, as well as miniature painting. He is author of The Spy of the Heart and translator of classic Sufi poetry.
Thank you very much. It's a very beautiful movie shooting, and one of the things, it's such a close, intimate look, and a lot of people speaking, but also nonverbal communication. And the thing that struck me as one of my teachers of language and Afghan music was wonderful man Ibrahim Waiz, who taught me to play rubab, the instrument you saw in the film. And he used to say to me, this is the ruh bab, which in Persian Arabic means it's the gate of the spirit. and the Afghans think that way pretty much about everything. So art is to express and to inspire. So spirit needs a vessel or a way to carry its ineffable quality to the person. And also, people who experience that spirituality can't help themselves. They're like springtime and they have to express themselves. So the two people that I want to talk about briefly, because one could speak for hours and hours about this, I'll start with the first one I met was Humayun Itamadi, the last court miniaturist in the traditional style of court, of the court library, producing the books and the paintings for the books in the Royal Library. And when I found out that he was living in Alameda, I just couldn't believe it. And I had to go and meet him. And we hit it off right away. And I started a 20-year friendship, really. Both of these associations started out, of course, I was a student, and they started out with respect and introductions. Both of the relationships that I want to talk about, they turned into the deepest love, kind of love that you would have with your favorite uncle or your favorite mentor, and where you were sharing just about everything. They were giving you advice on everything, you know, by the time you were finished. And with Humayun Itamadi, I should say I don't have the talent to be a miniature painter, but I had a desire to understand that form. So I learned things like how to make the kinds of brushes, like how can they make such fine lines in these paintings? And so all of this would take a lot of time to explain, but it will hopefully be in a book that I will write about this. But the thing that I wanted to stress it, because he stressed it, I said to him, is, what about Western art? Is Western art, mutasawif, is it spiritual? And he said, if it's art, of course it's carrying spirit. He said, Western art, Eastern art, and any art, this is the vessel of spirit. And if you come here, please don't bring your ego here. Come, and we can play with our egos later on. It'll be fun. But here, this is here, come and purify ourselves and sit, paint. So it was long, wonderful hours of drinking tea, painting, learning to mix paints. And one last thing I'll say about him is that you do have to get used to a different way of doing things. So the first time he said, please do a composition. And so I sketched a composition. And it took me several days to prepare this composition because it's very involved. And he came and he looked at it, and I was all just full of anticipation that he would love it. And he came up with a large eraser and smiling at me in the most loving way, he started to erase away most of the details that I had prepared. And this is where, as a Westerner, you know, one has to just melt, just accept, just anyway, it was a very loving relationship. He passed away a couple of years ago. The second person I want to talk about is Ras Muhammad Zahreh, the Afghan Sufi, who, as we were saying earlier, we've just produced a book of his poetry in translation, which you can get. So I met him around 1991, 92, and he's a teacher of Sufism, the spirituality that is in all of the arts, literature, and life of Afghanistan. And those last 18 years, whatever it's been, again, it's learning to surrender to a kind of way of just staying in the moment with this teacher and to try to share or be open to sharing and receiving, therefore, his state of spirit, the beauty of his soul, and to feel tangibly a person who is like a fire, first of all, like a raging fire that's emanating sparks. That's how much power and energy. And on the other hand, it's like sitting with a quiet lake at the same time. An astonishing kind of experience. Someone who has a lot of unusual, very unusual experience, and to sit and be receptive and learn. And this, of course, turns into a loving relationship. Anyway, so much of it is hard to explain, but summarizing in all of these cases, to express and to inspire, that's the nature of the spirituality of Afghanistan. Thank you.
Shireen Pasha is a storyteller and filmmaker whose first film short was The Roti Eaters, about an immigrant Muslim family in America responding to hate with love. Her current movie, Slowly, Slowly, Mud and Lotus, will be completed soon.
The geology of India, the Indian plate, has produced something called the lotus, which grows in murky water, water that is neglected. It's like water that you would find in a ditch. And the amazing thing about a lotus is that despite all the odds, it finds a way to bloom, and it's beautiful. And in all of these Indian subcontinent languages, there's a saying that gobore poddopur, like, you know, excuse my language, in shit you can find the most magnificent lotus flower. And that is what life is like. That's what Gautama Buddha, that's the flower he used to explain that you can transform your life like a lotus, no matter what circumstance you're living with in. And so about 2,000 years ago, we had a horrible ruler who transformed his life after battling spaces and killing thousands and thousands of people. His name was Ashoka, and he decided he was going to spend the rest of his life spreading peace and the message that if you look within, you can transform your life like a lotus. And so Ashoka, about 2,000 years ago, sent his family members and his monks all the way to Israel, to Japan, spreading the message of the lotus. And Afghanistan is one of the places where this message went to. And lotuses are still revered. It is the flower that is carved in the woodwork, in the adobe work. And I'm so thankful of symbolism. You know, we tend to take symbolism for granted in our industrial world. But I'm so thankful that it's helping us retrace our roots, what we have found in the past, and how we can rediscover.
Bina Sarkar Elias is founder, publisher, editor, and designer of Gallery, an award-winning global arts and ideas journal published in India. Much of Bina's work is driven by the need to bridge cultural divides.
Well, what I have to say is basically, Gallery, the magazine that I edit, design, and publish, is something that emerged out of a not out of commercial reasons, but just out of a compulsion to want to contribute to the world in some way, and that is my the core of what I do is wanting to bridge divides in the world and to bring communities and cultures together to generate understanding and awareness, to celebrate diversity, and especially more so because the world is increasingly getting more fragmented, and I feel that I mean, I don't have the strength of governments and all the ammunition that they come with to, you know, respond to what they're doing. But I feel in my way, in with words and images, with engaging in discourses like this, we can touch some lives, we can provoke thinking. And what better way than through the arts, through poetry, essays, cinema, photography, all of these different definitions of art. And this is what we do in galleries, so with galleries. So we have one, two issues a year. One is focuses on a country and the contemporary artistic situation, socio-political, of this time, and then the other issue is an idea. The reason why I did Afghanistan now is because one was Afghanistan intrigued me since the time I was a little girl, and Satyajit Ray had made this film on Kabuliwala, and Kabuliwala is what we call the Afghan man, the man in his Pashtun clothes with his beard and very scary looking. For a child, you know, as a child I was really scared of them. And it was beautiful that Tagore, Satyajit Ray brought this out in through Tagore's story of the Kabuliwala, where this very scary looking Kabuliwala befriends a little girl and they have this wonderful relationship of getting to know each other. And I thought, you know, I mean, this whole thing about the Taliban is just as I was scared of the Kabuliwala as a kid. Today, I think most people are scared of Afghanistan because of the Taliban. And I said, but that's not Afghanistan. That's just one group of people. That's really not the everyday Afghan I came across. I spent a whole month researching this issue in Afghanistan, and I met wonderful people. And through every strata of life there, from the taxi driver to a member of parliament to school teachers to embroiderers, I met all kinds of people, and they were so wonderful. And that's what I want to show. That there is an Afghanistan the world doesn't know about, and that Afghanistan is very palpable. It's there, and it's in the issues of gallery. If you can just show the copy that you have, we even have carried a music, a CD of Afghan music. It's exquisite. You have to listen to Afghan music. There is here. A CD of Afghan music, which comes with the issue, and there is Shireen's film, which also comes with the issue, and which we hope people will share with, you know, friends and colleagues. So this issue, Understanding Afghanistan, is again one more effort in bridging divides. I think a lot of you would relate to this poem because, I mean, it's the language of the migrant, you know, people moving from place to place. It's called Neptune Avenue by Zora Said. On the streets of Brighton Beach, when we swing from fire escapes and jump on the hoods of cars, we own the block through the force of our play and the clicking and clacking of our tongues. Ah, the power of 10 children and their own language. It is enough. We are our own gang, self-sufficient when we are not bound to school. We exist happily on fragmented languages. The breadcrumb of slang from the many streets we grew up in, Kabul, Mazar, Jalalabad, Riyadh, Jeddah, and Brooklyn. Uh-huh. Our language is the roof we carry over our heads. even when we are separated into different classes at school. If only mothers would let us be. We'd rather stretch our weekends and wrap it across the belly of the year. We'd rather dangle out every day on the fire escapes of the second floor mosque, spill the khutbah onto the sweating concrete by opening the windows wide, then jump onto the sidewalk, align our velvet prayer mats next to parked cars, and play imam and ummah as passers-by gawk at the magic of our flying carpets and at 1 5-year-old brother, serious-faced, hand over ear, singing out the call to prayer with a sugar-sweet throat. We quit school. We quit suspecting lunch ladies of slipping in slivers of swine while we aren't looking. We are willing to live within the bubble of cousins praying or gossiping in wild tongues, gossiping in wild tongue flips as neighbor children stare in awe. When their mouths ache from the strain of our language, we blow kisses at them. We have won another battle of the streets, but still our mothers want us to clean our rooms and fathers demand our report cards. What choice have we? In the day, our mothers are the sun, and at night, our fathers. To mark the celestial transition, mothers sit in the kitchen an hour before fathers come home. They hide behind the steam of cooking, while we children stand in line with colorful plastic combs in hand, waiting our turn by the only mirror we can reach on our own. Later, we visit them to approve us and prepare our welcome for fathers. Our tough skins are for the block and for the neighbors. At home, we are forever courting our parents with neatly combed hair, sweet voices, trimmed nails, and memorized prayers. We are the constellation. We shine each time they smile at us.
There was an excerpt from Liminal Spaces, Afghan Culture and the Future of South Asia. A reminder that the Grace Cathedral's Gershom Hall in San Francisco, doors open at 6:30, event starts at 7. You can join me for the book launch. My book is called Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror. In it, I share the verbatim stories of women, particularly mothers from Iraq, Israel in the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, Iraqi refugees predominantly in Syria, Afghanistan, the United States. Also talk with a lot of American military troops and military parents. This is the beginning of a tour that will go to Portland, Oregon. In Washington State, we'll be in Seattle, Tacoma, and Lakewood, where there is a GI Voice coffee shop just outside the gates of the U.S. Army base Fort Lewis. From there, we go to Los Angeles and Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., New York, Boston, and end up on Mother's Day at Northampton, Massachusetts, where there will be a big painting of a mural inspired by Iraqi children's artwork. You can find out more about these events at www.mothersspeakaboutwarandterror.org. And you'll also find information about the April 28th event. Again, it's at the Gershom Hall in Grace Cathedral, which is up at the top of Knob Hill. Come and meet me. There'll also be other speakers. Asma Eshin will be there. Mary Tillman will be there. Rachel Avila, whose son was badly injured in Iraq. Also, Rahima Haya and Noura Khoury, a Palestinian-American woman. There'll be poetry, there'll be art, and there will be music. It'll be emceed by Rose Aguilar of KALW and music with Kayla Marin. All of the views expressed in this show are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. We'll go out again with the Chaos of Paradise.